Ayin Dalid 74, and the title of tonight is Upside Down. So this is the second chapter out of 11 in a row that were written by Asaph. We mentioned previously Asaph was the most prolific writer of Tehillim after David himself, having written a total of 12 chapters in Tehillim. In the past, we have explained Asaph as a Levite and a person who participated in Leviim. However, I do feel it's only fair to mention that there is another contrasting opinion in the Mefarshim as to who Asaph was. And there is an opinion, the Medrash says, that Asaph was actually one of the sons of Korach, the only one who merited to have his own name mentioned. Because he was such a Talmud Chacham, he merited to have his own name mentioned rather than just have it written as B'nai Korach. However, we have been working with the opinion that Asaph was a Levi and someone who was more or less a contemporary in the period of the monarchy. However, there is also an opinion that Asaph was one of the B'nai Korach. Another interesting thing I thought I would mention about Asaph is Chazal have a tradition that Socrates, the great Greek philosopher who rejected idol worship, received all of his learning and tradition from Asaph and Achitophel. And that while in this year we are not going to learn Socrates, were we to learn Socratic philosophy, we would find a lot of things in it that come from Asaph. And in fact, that's what led Socrates to reject. And we think of Greeks as idol worshippers, and they had all the, you know, the Greek mythology. However, the philosophers of the Greek society, such as Socrates, were not. They did not buy into that. The Greek mythology was for the masses. And the reason he did not is he had a tradition of philosophy and study that had been handed down all the way from the time of Asaph and influenced Socrates. Now, in the last chapter of Tehillim, last week, Asaph was questioning why wicked people seem to materially prosper. You see people who aren't conducting themselves in a proper manner, so you understand maybe why they don't get a lightning bolt zapped down on them, but why do they have to be so darn successful? Why do they have to have two homes and a Lexus and a vacation every week? Right? So that was last week's question. Asaph now moves on to a new question, and his question is, why is the standing and the stature of the Jews, of the B'nai Israel in exile, such that we are scorned by the nations? Why is it that we are viewed by the nations of the world with such contempt and scorn? The Medrash says that Asaph asked Hashem this question. This is a Medrash. And that Hashem told him, you know what? I didn't abandon the Jews. They abandoned me when they did their Averos and I had to destroy the base of Mikdash. Asaph responded back that Hashem's name and his goal of people coming close to Hashem suffer in exile as well. And the Medrash says Hashem did not answer that. These are good questions. And Asaph takes his pen here and he writes this capital in three sections. The first section he's going to talk about our fate. The second section he's going to praise Hashem. And the third section he's going to ask for mercy. So in the first section, let's just start right away. He starts in verse 1. Page 1, side 1. It says, Maskil Asaph. This is a maskil, an instructive capital from Asaph. Lama Elohim. Hashem, why? Zanata lanetzach. Why have you forsaken us forever? Yeshan avcha b'tzor marisecha. Why is your wrath kindled against the flock of your pasture? Now, when he says lanetzach, for eternity, what he's complaining about, or complaining is maybe not the right term, but what he's unhappy about or questioning about, is that, you know, we were in Golas once before. We went to Bavel. We were told by the Navi that we'd be in exile for 70 years. It had a defined period of time, and then we came back. So now we're sent into exile. And see you later. But Netzach, it's an eternity. How long has it been? that we've been in exile with no idea when we're coming back. He says, why is it that you are abandoning us to this idea of eternity? What happened to, oh, you know what, I'm taking care of the Jewish people. They're going to go into exile as a punishment, and after a certain amount of time, they're coming. What happened to that? Why is it, Lenetzach, you've abandoned us, and the flock of your pasture? It's so, and what does a shepherd do with stray sheep? He doesn't kick them out for thousands of years. He gently guides them back into the grazing area, and he doesn't get angry with them. So he says, why? Well, hold on there. Now, this is a big introductory verse. Usually in the introductory verses, we have Maskil L'Asaf, Mizmor L'David. Asaf is bursting at the seams with this question. It is Maskil L'Asaf. Why, Hashem, are you not treating us like a shepherd, and you've abandoned us to what seems like an eternity with no idea when we're supposed to go back? He then goes on to say, Zechor Adasecha, remember your congregation, your people, Kanisa Kedem, which you acquired in the days of old, Gaalta, and you redeemed Shevet Nachalasecha, the tribe of your inheritance, Har Tzion, Ze Shachantabo, and Har Tzion, where your Shechina dwelt. Asaf is saying, Hashem, why aren't you remembering three things? The first thing is Zechor Adasecha, remember the Jewish nation. For that's the whole purpose of creation, is to give the Torah to the Jews. If it weren't for that, then why do we even need creation? He's saying, so Zechor Adasecha, remember your congregation. And he says, the tribe of your heritage, remember, Shevet Nachlasecha. The tribe of your inheritance refers to the second thing that Asaf wants Hashem to remember, which is that he brought us out of Mitzrayim in order to make us his nation. You left us for this eternity. Well, the whole world was created for us. You brought us out of Egypt so that we would be your nation. And finally, Har Tzion, remember also that your Shechina is supposed to be dwelling in Yerushalayim. So these are three things. Hashem, remember these three things and stop with the eternity. Just as an aside, it's so interesting to see the difference in style between Asaf and David. You know, Asaf writes, you know, David's, so far, most of the Kapitulach are very poetic. And sometimes, you know, the words and the order and how they go, you have to sort of figure it out a little bit. Asaf seems like, you know, what we would call today a straight shooter. Right? Listen, Hashem, I love you, but I got to tell you, it's an eternity down here. What happened to your congregation? What happened? You took us out of Mitzrayim, so we should be your people. What are we doing out here for another 1,000 years? Right? And what about your Shechina dwelling in Yerushalayim? Right into the point. Now, what's really interesting, and unfortunately, I'll comment, is Shevet Nachalasecha, one tribe took out. What happened to the other tribes? So they all say, refers to it as Shevet, because at that point, all of the Jews were united as one people. David HaMelech usually calls us Shevatim, different tribes, which could indicate where we are. But Shevet, at that point, we were one tribe, so he calls us one big tribe. So remember these things, Hashem. Harimefa Amecha. Lamashuos Netzach. Raise up your blows and inflict eternal ruin. Kol Hera Oyev Vakaydesh. For all the evil that the enemy did to your sanctuary. Now, the evil the enemy did to your sanctuary refers, as it probably could figure out, to the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. But it refers to more than that. For all the evil that the enemy did, they did not just destroy the Beis Hamikdash. Right? They defiled it, they ransacked it, they pillaged it, they played in it. It wasn't just destroying the Beis Hamikdash. They came and they did evil in it. In the Beis Hamikdash. Can that, how Hashem, can that not raise you to do something now? Shalgu Tzorarecha, your adversaries roared, Bekerav Moedecha, in the midst of your holy meeting place. Salmu Osasim Osas, they made their signs there in place of your signs. Now the Medrash says this refers to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed and conquered Israel and destroyed the first base of Mikdash, was unsure whether his next war should be against Ammon or should be against Israel. So what he used to do is he took a whole bunch of arrows. Nebuchadnezzar, this evil guy, wanted to know what God thought. This guy who was going to do unspeakable atrocities to the Jewish people wanted to check with God first. So he shot the arrows in all different directions, And they all landed facing Israel. So he took that as a sign that he should proceed next to Israel. So he says, they placed your signs for signs. Instead of using, they used your own signs, Hashem, to come and to conquer us. In Pasuk Hey, in verse 5, it says, Yevadig Mevi Lamala, may he be known as bringing on high, Bizvach Eitz Kardumos, and that the hatchets were in the thickets of the trees. Now, even though this is pretty straightforward, it needs a little bit of explanation. Because the hatchets were in the thicket of the trees, okay, that sounds good. That's easy to understand if you know Hebrew, but what in the world does that mean? So, the assault on the base of Mikdash by Nebuchadnezzar and any other nations were really an assault on Hashem. The Medrash says that Nebuchadnezzar had a commander, a general, who was in charge of breaking down the walls of Yerushalayim. And his name was Nebuzaradon, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. If not, I'm not going to ask him to forgive me. Nebuzaradon needed weapons to attack Yerushalayim. So Nebuchadnezzar sent him 300 wagons pulled by donkeys, and each one of the wagons was loaded with the strongest steel hatchets that could be made in Babel. So 300 wagon loads of hatchets. That's a lot of hatchets. And Nebuzaradon used these hatchets to try and break down the gates of Yerushalayim. And he threw all the hatchets, which should have been enough to destroy anybody and anything, and the doors didn't budge. So Nebuzaradon was about to leave. He remembered the story of Sanherib, where Sanherib, the Assyrian general, had thought he was going to conquer Yerushalayim, and he woke up the next morning, his entire army was killed. And he said, you know what? It must be that my boss, Nebuchadnezzar, has it wrong. Must be that their God does not really want us to destroy Yerushalayim now. A voice came out from Shemayim and said, stop. And told him that the time had come and he should throw his last hatchet. He threw one hatchet. It broke the gates and the walls and they crumbled down. Says Asaph, the hatchets were in the thicket of the trees. He's metaphorically saying that the hatchets were laying all over. There were so many hatchets around the walls, it looked like it was a forest of trees. There were so many hatchets. And then Hashem allowed one hatchet to break it down. And now its entrance is together. With hatchets and hammers they struck. With one hammer. Now it says, their entrances were together. What that means, the together, I would translate that a little differently. I would say entrances all together in one. And what he means by that is it wasn't just enough to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Afterwards, they sent teams back to search through the ruins of the Beis HaMikdash to see what they could salvage. Not enough that we just destroyed their temple and took them into... Let's see what else we could find. Like all their entrances were like one. Everything was raised, and the people could just walk in at will and take whatever they wanted. All of the entrances were as one. There was no exit or entrance. They could just pick their way through and take whatever they wanted. Shilchu va'esh mikdashecha, they set your sanctuary on fire. La'aretz, to the ground, chilu mishkan shemecha, they profaned the dwelling place of your name. The Nebuzaradon didn't just break down the walls and then head straight to the base of Mikdash. He killed every single person on the way. And they, it says, profaned your name. Nebuzaradon, as the Medrash says, was pretty proud of himself. Nobody had ever done this. Conquer the Jewish people and destroy their temple. His career was set. He was going to get a big promotion and raise. This was nobody in the whole world, civilized world, had ever done such a thing before. The Medrash says a baskol came out and said, don't be so proud of yourself. All you did was grind up flour that was already ground up. Now, you were the instrument, perhaps, that did it, but don't be so proud of yourself. You know, and there's a lot of musar in that statement. For Nebuzaradon was very proud of himself. But Hashem was telling him, listen, the flour is already ground up. You can do what you want, but it really doesn't matter. Hashem is in charge of everything to do with whether or not you're going to be successful. People tend to forget that all success or failure in battle comes from Hashem. This is true even today in Eretz Yisrael. People think that, you know, if only the army will do this, or if only the army will do that, then we could defend ourselves against the terrorists. Then we could do this. Well, Hashem ish melchama. Nebuchadnezzar, don't be so proud of yourself. It really wasn't you. It really wasn't you. I decided it had to be done, and you were the instrument that I allowed to do it.
Rabbi,
yes.
A real example was the Six-Day War in Eretz Israel.
Yes.
You had to be blind if you didn't think that.
Yes. Mrs. Gordon brought up this for the tape that an example was the Six-Day War, and I'll tell you a great story about that. Not that I ever digress. And that is that, and the story is in a book. Oh my, the name of the book is eluding me right now. But there was a command, this was actually in the 1948 War of Independence. And the commander of the Haganah, the Jewish forces in Tzfas, was in what would be considered a bleak situation. The Arab armies were approaching. He had minimal supplies, minimal training. We've all read stories that this was not exactly the super army, right? That without Hashem's help, this would have been a difficult situation. So a reporter who was there, and this was published at the time and it's been in books later, asked him, "You really think you're going to win this?" He said, "Well, one of two things are going to happen. Either we're going to win this the Jewish way, or we're going to need a miracle." Well, that's too good of a statement to pass up. So he says, "What do you mean by that?" He says, "Well, we could win this the Jewish way." What is that? Well, the Malachim are going to come down and they're going to smite all of the Arab armies and we're going to walk out of here with no problem. But if me and my ragtag guys can beat the Arabs, that will be a miracle. Right? So Hashem is guiding those things. When it comes to battle, that a person may be the instrument like Nebuchadnezzar was, but it doesn't mean that he can take pleasure that he did it himself. There is one other interesting medrash about the fact that when it set the sanctuary on fire, when the Beis HaMikdash was on fire, now remember, what was the Beis HaMikdash made out of? Stone. Stones don't burn. So when the Beis HaMikdash was on fire, which obviously was not a good sign, since stones don't burn, the Beis HaMikdash, Chazal tell us in the medrash, tried to rise up from the ground and return to the Shemayim. And Hashem slapped it back down and sent it back to the ground, telling it that its place was there to be destroyed. Amru Belibam, they said in their hearts, Ninam Yachad, these rulers together, these kings, Sarfu Kol Moade Keil Ba'aretz, we've burned all the meeting places of Hashem in the land. Now, Ninam is translated here as rulers, and Rashi says it's from the word that means monarch. However, the Sephorno says that's not the correct translation of the word Ninam, and he says that what Ninam means is descendants. And he says the way he would translate this verse is Amru Belibam, they said in their heart, the descendants will be as one, so they burnt all the meeting places in the land. Why, after you burnt the Beis HaMikdash, do you have to go around burning all the shuls and batei midrashim? You know what? You burnt the Beis HaMikdash. You killed 1 million people. You sent them all into exile. It's a day's work. Now you have to go around burning shuls too? Why did they have to do that? They did that because they realized that the only way to conquer Klal Yisrael is spiritually. Nebuchadnezzar, when he took the people into exile, gave instructions to his commanders not to let them stop walking. Better they should die than stop walking. Because if they stop walking, they might do teshuvah, or they might daven, and then it's all over. It wasn't enough that they had to physically destroy them. They knew that if we don't spiritually destroy them, they'll be back. So they went around and they burnt all the meeting places of Hashem in the land. They burnt every shul. They burnt every Beis Medrash. They burnt every place that might give spiritual encouragement to the Jewish people. Also, Seinu lo ra'inu, we have not seen our signs. Ein od navi, we have no more prophet. Velo itanu yodei adma, nobody knows how long it's going to be. Admasai Elohim, how long, Hashem? Yicharitzar. Awesome. What, till when? How long? Yinaitz ayev shimcha lenetzach. Is your enemy going to disgrace your name forever? Brings two different people here, a tsar and an oyev. A tsar is someone who degrades Hashem out loud and says, look, Hashem can't help the Jewish people. And an oyev is someone that degrades Hashem only in private, in his thoughts. But also, if it doesn't matter, both of them are equally bad, and both of them need Hashem's punishment. Lama tashiv yadcha, why do you withdraw your hand, v'minecha, your right hand, your Heavenly Beloved, mikarev chekha chale, draw it out from within your bosom. What's interesting is that, you know, you have the idea of the classic Napoleon pose with his sort of hand and his thing like that. That's what this is referring to. Napoleon didn't invent that. That was a sign of inaction. If someone's to do something, and your response was to put your hand like this, that was a sign. Too bad for you. I'm not going to help you. Napoleon, even though he may have made it famous, he didn't invent that sign. That was always a body language sign that said, no, I don't think so. Because how long are you going to keep your hand like this, Hashem? Until now, Asaf has been listing his complaints, if you will. His questions to Hashem. Ad Masai, how long? An eternity? Two eternities? Now he's going to praise Hashem. He's going to say, Velokim, Malki Mikedem. You're my king from the very beginning of time. Poel Yeshuos Bekerev Haaretz, and whose works are salvations in the midst of the earth. Now when it says you're my king from before, from the old days, a lot of the Mefarshim say Asaf is feeling a bit of, I don't know, the nostalgia is not the right word, but a bit of longing for the glory days, if you will. Remember, there was a time when Israel was on top of the world. Every country came to pay tribute to Shlomo HaMelech. There was nothing like us. Everyone recognized our God was the top God. He says, Malki, when are we going to go back to how it was before? That's how it was. Ata barata b'azniyam, you crumbled the sea with your might. Shibarta roshe saninim, you shattered heads of sea monsters on the water. Not only did you split the Yamsuf, he split it into 12 sections for each shavit to go through. Ataritzatzta, you crushed the heads, the Roshe Livyason, the heads of the Livyason, Titinenu Michael La'am Litzion, and you gave it as food to the people in companies. Now he's referring to the Pesukim in the Navi and Yeshaya that talk about at the end of days Hashem drawing a sword and killing the Livyason. But what he's alluding it to is you crushed the heads of the Leoson, who was the most powerful people in the world, was Paro in Egypt. Not only did you crush Paro, but you gave it as food to the people. You gave us all the booty, and we took out all their possessions and all their gold and all their silver, and you crushed them. Ata bakata ma'ayim v'nachal, you split fountain and stream, ata kovasha, you naharos eson, you dried up waters. Lecha yom, day is yours. Af lecha laila, night is yours. Atachni noisa me'or v'shemesh, you established the boundary. Hashem, you decided such an elemental concept as day and night. How much greater can you get than that? Ata itzavta, you set all the boundaries, kol gavulos haaretz, all the boundaries of the earth, where the land will be, the water will be, kayetz v'choref, you made earth and winter, ata itzavtam, you created all of this. All I'm asking, you look at Shema, we know how great you are. Zachar zos ayev, erev Hashem, remember. Now he's going to ask for things. So far he said what his problem is, and he's pointed out that we recognize the greatness of Hashem. So what is it you want, Asaf? What is your tefillah? His tefillah is Zachar Zos Ayev, Cherif Hashem. Remember how the enemy reviled Hashem, the Am Naval, the Atzu Shemecha, and how the people blasphemed your name. I want you to remember that, Hashem. Remember who stood by Hashem and who didn't. Al titein l'chayis nefesh torecha. Don't deliver to the company of your soul, dav chayis in yecha, the soul of your poor ones. Al tishkach l'netzach. Don't forget us. Once again, we see that Asaph has a way with words very different than David. Al tishkach l'netzach. Don't forget us. No poetry needed. Right. Simple request. Don't forget us, Hashem. It's been a netzach. It's been an eternity. With no idea what's happening. And look where we find ourselves in. We're not even in the relatively good gullus of Bavel, where we were there and we were able to prosper. We came back 70 years. Look what we're in. Habet Labris, look to the covenant you made with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Ki malu mechach she'eretz na'os chamas. For the dark places of the earth are filled with dwellings and violence. All the places that we've been sent to, now we're sitting here in Chicago, doesn't seem like such a bad place. If you review over all the places that the Jews have been in exile in the last 2,000 years, I think you'd find plenty of places that are filled with dwellings of violence. Not the ones you can see. You think there's no dwelling of violence in the United States, in Chicago? You think that it wouldn't take that for the situation to change? Now, I've always debated whether to give this example because it often, you know, he's, you know, some sort of lunatic, scaremongering, crazy type person. But in 1930 in Germany, everything was hunky-dory. In 1935 in Germany, nobody could leave anymore. And in 1940, they were all dead. That's just a simple fact. You can take from that whatever you will. In 1930, you could not have found a million of people. You could not have found 10 people in Germany that thought there was any reason to leave or do it. So I'm certainly not advocating we all leave Chicago. But what I'm saying is that when he says that the places of the earth are filled with dwellings of violence, it's not just referring to awful, horrible places that we see are awful and horrible. It's like any place can become awful and horrible. You don't know what Hashem has in mind for a particular place. Every place we've sent to has the potential to be filled with violence. Al yashov dach nichla, ani ve'evyo and yahalu shemecha. Don't let the poor turn back. The poor and needy will praise your name. Kuma Elokim, rise. Riva rivecha, zechor charpasecha miyinavol kol yom. Plead your own cause. You know what, Hashem? You don't need us telling the nations of the world how great you are. Do it yourself. Remember your disgrace from a villainous man, all the days. People look around. And we have it all the time in Nach. What are the nations to say? Ayye Elokeichem. Where is your God now? You know what? Hashem, defend yourself. And he finishes with it. He says, Al tishkach kol tzorecha. Don't forget the voice of your adversaries. So not only do I want you to help you, don't forget, Hashem, who got us into this situation. Sha'on kamecha. People who rise up against you, Ola told me, which constantly ascend. He's referring here to what we would popularly call Roman, Greek, modern culture. Chazal tell us that in Rome was such a bustling metropolis and such a center of the world that the din, the noise from the city of Rome could be heard from one end of the world to the other. Now, I don't know whether literally that's accurate or not, but Chazal are trying to make a point about Rome. And that is, today, we still live with Rome. We still live with Greece and Rome. Everything in America, everything in Western society is based on Greece and Rome. The way our economy works, the way our politics works, our philosophy, the whole idea of what's called modern liberalism, humanitarianism, all of these different things that the enlightened Western person is supposed to believe in, all come from Greece and Rome. Rome's been dead a long time. It's not dead, say Chazal. It's not dead at all. It's as live as it ever was. You can hear it from one end of the world to the other. Rome still rules us. And Greece still rules us. And he says, don't forget that. The tumult arising. These people are constantly ascending. We can't fight against this. You have to help us, Hashem. it's interesting if you look, for example, at civil law in America. It's an interesting mishmash of half Greek-Roman ideas and half biblical ideas. It's like as if someone randomly took pages of the Talmud and randomly took pages of the Roman law book, smushed them all together, and said, here's a new system for you. I remember I was talking to someone who had just started law school, and in the beginning, the first class you take is torts, one person suing another. So he opened up his textbook to torts. The very first example case is a cow gores somebody. Now, probably most of the people in this class don't learn a lot of Gemara. But the first Gemara you learn in fifth grade is about a cow goring someone and what happens to the cow. And it was literally, almost word for word, two pages of Gemara that were stuck into this law book. On the next page was all about the rights of the individual, which could have been ripped out of something from Greece or Rome. These ideas that we have today all come from if you look around the world today, you can only describe it as a topsy-turvy world. I don't even know where to start. In our society, what used to be considered deviant lifestyles is considered whatever you want to do. Tithes run wild. Kids, young people don't respect elder people. The world today is can only be described as mixed up. It doesn't seem to be, and the Jews get blamed for everything. You think it's bad here, go to Israel. Oh, it rained today. Must be the Froom people's fault. Right? They must have died of fright. Everything is blamed. Right? The world, and that's not the only part that's topsy-turvy. Everything is upside down. And that's what Asaph is describing. Hashem, this is an upside-down world you've got us in over here. Rome is ascendant. That's the ideas we're following. We don't know when you're going to punish your enemies. It seems like an eternity here. You've put us into this upside-down world with no idea when it's going to end. When is it going to end, Hashem? When are we going back to a world that we would recognize? And you know, in our times, anybody ask their grandparents what the world was like and compare it to now. Right? The world is even more topsy-turvy. And even more likely that the Jews are blamed for it. I remember, this was an interesting thing, someone had written into one of the Jewish newspapers a number of years ago, and they had said, you know, I don't understand something. There was a whole big, what was this, like 400 years, a whole big tumult in Israel, and it was all being blamed on, quote-unquote, the Haredi communities, which couldn't have had less to do with it. But the newspapers were decrying this. And they said, if Hashem loves us, and Hashem wants us to be His chosen people, why does He let the world rip us to shreds in public? Why does He let this topsy-turvy situation exist? Okay, we're in Gullis. Why does it have to be a topsy-turvy Gullis? Why can't we be in Gullis, and we're being punished, and we don't have the base of Mikdash, and we're subject to pogroms and this, but why the upside? Why is the world backwards from common sense? So the person answered him and said, you know, I really don't know the answer to your question, but I would suggest something to think about. He said that in politics, everybody thinks they know what to do. You know, if I was just this afternoon, I had a chavrusa actually with the scoop of his husband, and we're learning basar b'chol. So, you know, you drop your spoon, your fleshik spoon, into the melted pot. What do? You ask somebody what to do. As soon as we get to that chapter, you can ask us. Just a little joke. Right? So, you know what? I got a chicken. I don't know what to do. And I might betray it. What should I do? Oh, Rabbi Shabbos, what should I do? Right? Oh, you know what? Rabbi, who would be a good shidduch for my son or daughter? We always ask either halachic shilas or we ask guidance from our rabbanin, except when it comes to politics. Everybody's a Talmud Chacham of politics. You know, all we have to do is this party could do this, if they run this guy for premier, everybody schmoozes over the table, they're all experts on politics. And then while they're at the middle of that table, the guy says, if, you know, the meat and the milk got mixed up, they're running, they ask the rub. So he says it could be that Hashem is telling them, you know what, you want to be an expert, I'll leave it in your hands. You want to make a mess of it, make a mess of it. You think you know, fine, you know. So live with the results. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's something that is definitely is related to the topsy-turvy world, something to think about. Right. And we're going to bring this together in a second, because there is an idea of Mita Kenegan Mita. The idea that when we contribute to the world being topsy-turvy by our own attitudes. The more we try and live according to the proper Jewish way, the less topsy-turvy the world has to be. The more we decide we're smart enough to figure it out on our own, we're not very good at that. It becomes very topsy-turvy. Asaph has a specific tefillah here. Even though every pasuk he's asking when, he really wants one thing. Hashem, I understand that certain things have to happen in the world. I understand we have to go into Gullus. I understand that. But you know what? Put the world back right. That's all. At least put the world back right. Why should we have to live in a world that's upside down? Why should we have to live in a world whose midos and values and conduct is 100% opposite everything that Hashem wants us to do? Step out in the world today and tell me that the world conducts itself the way Hashem wants it to. Why should we have to live in that world? In Bavel, in the first Gullus, we lived in our own little community, isolated from the mainstream Babylonian culture. And while it's true, I'm not trying to minimize the difficulties or all the things that we had to go through in Gullus, but we didn't have to go out and mix it up with an upside down world. We had other things that we had to do. So now here, for thousands of years, the world is getting progressively worse, and it's upside down. So Asaph is saying, you know what? Don't forget the people that are ascending and trying to fight against you. Don't forget this. Put the world back. Put the world back. I don't know how long this has to go on, but however long it has to go on, could you at least put the world back to something that we could recognize? Something that when we walk out into the street, right? And Asaph is writing this thousands of years ago, right? That when we walk out into the street, we feel like we're in a world that Hashem is conducting. Fine, we're suffering our punishment, but why should I have to go out and have it compounded by the fact that the world is against me? That everything I do and everything I value, the world says is bad. Everything I think a person should do, the world says you shouldn't do. Everything I think is good, they think is bad. Everything I say is good, they say it's the Jews' fault. Right? And you know what, within the Jewish community, well, it's the from Jews' fault. Right? Why should I have to live in an upside-down world like that? Put the world back, Hashem. That's Asaph's tefillah here. Put the world back. At least, if you're not going to tell me how long this is going to last, put the world back so that I can live in it, and I can hold my head up, and I can walk outside and not feel like I don't know what I'm doing. That's Asaph's tefillah. And that's why David HaMelech included this in here. You know, David HaMelech decided what to include in the Tehillim. When Asaph had this kapitel written on a scroll, David HaMelech included this because the point is a tremendous one. When? I don't know when. But could we at least live in a world that's not upside down? When we're saying this kapitel, that's what we're looking for. You know it? Hashem, listen. We're always davening. We want everything. We want Gullah. We want the end of Gullah. We want everything. But you know what? Here's something. You know, while we're waiting, it wouldn't hurt if you put the world into a nice situation that we could live with. Questions? Yes, Ms. Gordon.
Not a question. It's a statement. My mother was the runner of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. When she was in Germany, she was it was very religious, and they lived like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And when she came to Chicago, she kept saying to me, you know, I can only think in German, because she wanted to go back to what it was. She came to the United States as a runner, had nothing but her laughters, and she was looking for something that was there, and she lived looking back at what was in Germany, because it was real. She told me that they always had a Shabbos party for the kids. To this day, that's what I do, that in memory of my mother, because that's what she remembered. And when she came to Chicago, she married a man who was American, and she thought that it was going to be wonderful here. But she kept thinking about what she had. Now, I have very religious family in New York, and I was given a picture of my great-grandfather. My great-grandfather was a big Tom McCoffin with payas and everything, and I thought my mother, who was a runner, she wanted to run away, and she didn't realize that what she had was really what was the real thing.
Your mother was never able to make peace with the topsy-turvy world that she found herself in. Just like Asaf. Asaf can't make peace with the world that he finds himself in.
Right.
It's a separate tefillah. He wants a world that he can make peace with. Right? The mother wanted the same thing. She wanted the world she knew, a world that she could walk out in and feel like she was a part of the world instead of shunted off into the corner.
So what she did is, we have very religious family in New York, mm-hmm. and she made sure that my children went to New York to find an example of what she had. And both of my kids are rebaim today because of that.
Very nice. Any other questions?